Hello and welcome to the Stories Mania podcast. We have a special edition podcast for you today. This podcast will cover every single Piece of the Year nominee. Of course, with exception to Oz Rebellion, since we have already done a podcast featuring that story. To vote on the Pieces of the Year podcast, please visit storiesmania.net. Our first piece is Deeds Undone. I killed my best friend. Now, I don't mean that figuratively, and I didn't do it accidentally. No car wreck, hunting accident, or childhood game gone wrong. No, I called him and asked him to meet me by the big tree in the park where we always met after sneaking out at night. Then I calmly walked up to him and shoved the Ginsu butcher knife, the one that came in the 1499 set off the TV, right into his throat. Look of surprise on his face actually made me laugh. I didn't mean to, it just popped out. I don't know if the pain I saw in his eyes was due to the knife sticking out of his throat, the fact that his best friend for the last 13 years had just killed him, or that I laughed about it. I couldn't help it. It was funny. That was the summer of 1985. Ronnie, the dead one, Kelly and I were inseparable. If one of us went somewhere, three of us did. Don't get me wrong, I loved Ronnie. I just loved Kelly more. However, I could see that Kelly was falling for Ronnie. They had started meeting without me, walking through the park, talking, holding hands. I know. I saw them. Follow them. He shouldn't have kissed her. She was meant for me. I remember that day, July 6, 1985. I remembered it because I relive it every night. Every night while I'm lying in bed next to Kelly and in the room down the hall from my 5-year-old daughter, Valerie. It never fails. I lay down, close my eyes, and fall asleep. Then I wake up, but I can't move. I know I'm awake. I can hear Kelly snoring softly next to me. Then those few fateful minutes flash through my mind, and I hear Ronnie's voice asking me, "Why?" I can't move. I try to move, but nothing happens. I try to scream. I can hear myself scream, but Kelly never wakes. It's not a dream. I mean, it can't be a dream if I'm awake, can it? I just want it to stop. I just want to sleep one night without this happening. I know a way. There is a way. I just don't know if I could take the chance of paying the price. I've never been much of a gambler, and what I could lose for a good night's sleep would be outstanding. The woman, crone, witch, whatever she is, told me what to do. She gave me the small clay figure of a clock and told me, "Break it, smash it completely. Throw it on the ground and grind it under your heel. When you've done this, you'll be back that night and you can make your decision again. You don't know everything, remember everything, your wife, daughter, everything. This is the price you have to pay to make amends. Can I do it? Can I relive my whole life knowing about this one? Knowing about the love Kelly and I share? Knowing about my gorgeous, loving, talented daughter? I've got to. I can't live like this anymore." I woke up this morning and got dressed. I grabbed the small pouch with the clay clock in it. Was it ticking? No, just my imagination. I walked downstairs to the kitchen and found Kelly at the table with Valor eating Fruit Loops. I replied, "Good morning," to her and gave her a kiss on the top of the head. I walked over to Valor and kissed her all over her face until she was laughing, saying, "Stop it, Daddy." I told Kelly that I wasn't hungry and then I kissed her and told her I loved her and I walked out the door. There was a chance that this would still be here in the future. We could grow up and still fall in love and still have Valerie, and maybe Ronnie would be the best man at her wedding, but I doubt it. I took out the pouch and opened up the drawstring. Turning it over, the clock slid out of my hand. It was ticking. Wild. I closed my eyes, whispering goodbye to Kelly and Valerie, and threw the clock on the ground and crushed it under my heel. I was in my room. Bon Jovi poster on the wall right next to Heather Locklear. Amazing. It worked. I missed Kelly and Valerie already. But I had another chance. I ran down the stairs, past the kitchen, past the Ginsu knife, and out the door. Ronnie was waiting there, just like he was last time. I ran up and hugged him, and he punched me and called me a faggot. I laughed, and I remembered last time I was here laughing. It was different now, though. Everything was going to be okay now. I told Ronnie that I knew that he and Kelly had been meeting and walking together. I told him about following him that night and seeing them kiss. Told him I was just so mad I ran home and cussed him and cried. Then I told him I was sorry. He just looked at me weird. He looked at me and then he told me something. He told me that when they went for walks, she talked about nothing but me. He told me that when he kissed her that night, Then she slammed him and said if he ever did it again, it would be the last time she talked to him. I couldn't believe it. I did that horrible deed for nothing. Lived with it haunting me for nothing. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that Kelly loved me. Couldn't believe it. My wonderful daughter would still be born. And I couldn't believe it when Ronnie shoved the Gitsu knife into my throat. She's mine, he said. You can't have her. And then he laughed at me. That was Deeds Undone by Wordsmith. Our next work in this special edition podcast is The Tiger's Woman by Edyen B.P. Here she was at last, after what seemed an eternity. He could smell her entering the ring and coming toward the steel bars that surrounded him. His muscles tensed and he raised himself from the sawdust floor in anticipation of the sting that she reeled in one of her hands. He began pacing up and down, flicking out each large paw individually in a deliberate and graceful movement whilst his head stayed fixed in the direction of her smell. Finally, the darkness moved, and the four white suns that only came with her presence lit his world. The ghost voices from the edges of the dark space around him began their babbling and murmuring, which he knew would turn into the sound of rain when she entered his world, but no water would ever fall from the cloudless sky above. Then, opening a hole in the steel, she was there in front of him, neither prey nor predator, that belonging to in his world, but in complete control of it. With her came the light and the food. She brought a warmth and provided the shelter. All she required was that he do her bidding from time to time and allow himself to jump and run when she bade him. Her stinger hand made a small thunder crack in front of him, and from out of his ground she picked up a tree with four smooth branches and wooden leaves, as though she were going to attack his face with it, although she never did. She shouted out in a sound, high and constant, and he knew that he should go and jump into the wooden rock in the far corner. He did so, and the rain sound came down and cleared from the darkness outside. She moved closer and shouted again, this time two sounds, one low, one high. He immediately showed her how he would climb a tree, standing on his back legs only and scratching the air. The rain sound came so loudly that it drowned her next sound. The stinger touched his flank and he shouted his pain so loudly that all noises seemed to stop. Even the rain died away to nothing. The silence was magical, and he remembered spreading through such silent nights at a time where he was the master of his world, and only he was the bringer of light and food and pain. The stinger bit him once, this time on the shoulder, but he did not shout or even flinch away. He smelled something far too interesting in the air. Mixed it with the animal smells, the strange foods and people smells of the darkness was something he recognized from before, a smell that meant power, a smell that could mean freedom. He opened his nostrils wide and drank in the rich liquids carried in the air, and knew that it was fear. He also knew the fear was inside the cage with him, with nothing but a stinger and a small tree with four branches to stop his mighty leap and to fight off his great swipe. He jumped down from his place and paced toward the source, the stinger constantly biting him around his body, but this time no more bothersome than a mosquito bite as he strode forward, with the intoxicating smell getting stronger and stronger all the time. Even when the tree was thrown at his head, he placed down until finally the smell was overpowering and he stood in front of a trembling figure making lots of small flattering sounds one after the other that had no meaning to all of him. He shouted to the darkness that he was the king once more, that the light would now do his bidding, that the rain would now bring water and only he would bring pain. Then he attacked. When he was done, he lay back down on the floor and waited. No rain come this time. No rain at all. Not even the slightest drip. Instead, he heard thunder in the darkness all around, the thunder of many clouds rumbling hurtling away through the darkness and drifting off into the safety of the night. He rested his head on his paws and savored the sweet, sticky taste of freedom. Surely, after all that thunder, water had to eventually fall. There was The Tiger's Woman by Edyen B.P. Welcome to the dark. Come in, fresh ones, and sit down with me. I'll take you somewhere you want to be, a place of darkness, brood, and hate, a place where evil fills the plates. I've given you this hall so dark and deep, where turmoil and insanity never sleep. Express yourselves as you wish and might. Hear the part of us we do not fight. So join me around this flame-lit table, where hope is irrelevant and time is unstable. Look, come, and please shut the door while I empty your tears and your blood on the floor. In payment, I ask only for your eternal soul. Place it here in this sturdy communal bowl, so that it all come can see your true self, displayed in a box in this hall on a shelf. The next piece is Westland by Everlight. The city of Westland has more buildings than it does people these days. Its many spires tower over its mammoth walls and lose themselves against the looming black granite mountains that rise behind the city. Stretching for miles at either side flows low-rolling farmland so that from on a high, the once regal city stands out like a red ruby floating over this, floating in a sea of vibrant green. 200 years ago, the rich soil in this land was prized by kings and commoners alike, and from it grew a nation renowned for the size and vigor of its people. But the nature of man makes peace rare, and war soon ravaged the country of Elsa. Blood-soaked boots carved wide swaths through golden wheat fields, fires fueled by bloody bones and abandoned homes burned day and night, sending sickly smoke skyward until it blacked out the sunlight. Its pugin odor offending every living thing for 1,000 miles around. The encroaching army that landed on serene shores and trampled through farmland did not look to surprise its opponent. It stopped and bellowed its way through the country, its only purpose to destroy the life and culture of Elsa. Driven by a hate so dark it cared little for the lives of even its own soldiers, so marched this horror through every village and city until the only sanctuary left to fleeing Elsa was the capital city of Westland. There they stood, groaning over their finest defenders to fight for the lives of their wives and children, fighting for the death, knowing what the cost of defeat would mean for those left behind. By day, the black mass jeered. By night, it poked and prodded the defenses of the city, driven on by its commander, King Judas Nestor, the Forsaken. When the tunnels carved under the city walls brought them down, his men rushed in to drag out every living citizen they could, and to the anguish of those who had made it safely behind the inner walls, he tortured thousands of innocents he called Elsa's last defender, Arthur Balor, the King of Essa. The invitation spawned a battle that climaxed with both armies spilling onto the plains of Noram, filling the naturally formed Colosseum until the canyon floor undulated with the sway of soldiers of battle, patches of red charging into shades of blue, the sound of trumpets blowing orders, competing with the clashing swords as men charged, banners flying. The soldiers of red fought for King Judas and wore the insignia of the Red Hammer. They were brutal and fearless, throwing themselves at their opponents in blue, who flew the banner of the Blue Ross, the army of King Bolowai, and for free people of Elsa. The battle turned when the form of cloudless sky came a bolt of blue lightning that struck the battling figure of King Bala, his form dissolving into ash in front of his champions. The usurper gave no quarter and ordered his men to slaughter to the last man all who wore the blue of Elsa. The men of the Rose fought outnumbered and besieged all around, and pride and bravery drove the sword with such withering ferocity that it seemed no mortal army could best them that day. But black magic despises morality, and accounts tell of slain soldiers in red that fell with fatal wounds only to rise again with sword in hand. The champions fought through blade and magic until exhaustion gripped them and death overtook them. The Dark King tore apart the remaining defenses, taking the sword to every man, woman, and child. They relentlessly tracked the fleeing family of the slain king into the deep of the forest until, with great celebration, he held above his head the crying babe that was the last of the royal bloodline. As he swung the terrified child into the pit, roaring louder the screams from the flames, he pledged to wipe out the memory of Elsa from the pages of history. For the rest of his short life, the savage king made sport of tracking down Elsa's with a relish to the hunter and to the fox. To this day, the evil Progeny still offers a reward of gold for the capture of any or killing of anyone thought to possess Elsa's blood. The historians of Nestor claim that none wearing the blue standard left the battlefield alive the day lightning killed Elsa's warrior king. The rumor claimed that one of honor did survive, critically wounded but obscured by the countless thousands of lifeless bodies that were strewn throughout the bloody battlefield. Of all the king's champions, there was one who was his most prized, a tenacious soldier who brought not only the skill, the sword, but nature's fury as well. Coming to battle flanked by tigers and wolves and predators from the air, he was an army to himself. In that final battle, he was one of the last to fall, and left among the dead, he was pulled from the carnage by a dying black wolf, dragged back into the thick of the forest. Many weeks he lay hidden deep in the burrows of the wood, nursed by the wild until he regained his strength. Long after his physical wounds healed, he suffered still from wounds borne by soldiers who lived to see their king fall before them. After long wandering, he came to accept that for him the war was over. His people had suffered grievously. It was now time to protect the few that survived. He settled upon finding a wife, a strong woman that would ensure that his bloodline survived, for he believed that within him was the power only the gods granted, a power that one day would be reborn through his bloodline and begin anew the fight that would bring freedom back to his people. It had been 200 years since the last fell defending Westland. Today the city is populated by the people of Nestor who migrated here after the conquest and take advantage of the vacant homes and prepared fields. From afar, the huge city was an uneasily red glow to it, a trait the superstition claimed was earned with countless thousands of defenseless Ulsans were murdered in their homes. Migrating Nestorians, who came to choose their home in Westland, often found a cowering skeleton crouched in a back room of an empty house, its yellowed skull with hollow eyes upturned, a figure frozen in terror, captured with its final vision of the face of its executioner. It's thought to be an ill omen, and few men would put his family in a bloodhouse, but one could find, for a gold coin or two, these who will cleanse any home of its tortured souls. Still, the red glow remains. Years pass and the population grows, but still most of the city's cobblestone streets lead only to haunted houses where upon the wind ride the faint echoes of a people long gone. Living among these usurpers, there is a secret community of Elsin men and women who make no mention of their outlawed heritage, not even to their own children. It is secret worthy of execution, and one must acknowledge the sentence for such a heritage before they are inhabited in the knowing. So few are willing now to bear that burden. Tales of avenging heroes are dismissed by Nestorians as the last gasp of a failed race, but misery feeds such stories, and it gives the descendants of the lost kingdom hope, Elsa, a country stripped of its own protectors, its people hunted and its history relegated to the whispers of those dwindling few who sing outlawed poems. In them survives the heart of the nation, and the prophecy of freedom, the home on the rays of the Red Dawn. Werewolf Red Reaper first to battle, savage blue blades who welcomes bloodshed. Springing beast to prey, gifted he who fought the flow, back host, hell's pirate, so many he brought low. But now, hell's servant, the hero dies, he lives. Elsin Lore. Chapter 1. The setting sun signaled an end to the day's work. The tall, muscular silhouette waving in his sons from the field stood stark against the wild blue sky. Caleb Amon was a man well respected by those that knew him, and those who didn't saw him in his deep green eyes and integrity and strength. He was intimidating, to be sure, but the smile that spent so much time on his face disarmed even the pettiest of men. With his hardy wife, he had two sons, brown-haired and broad, Tam the oldest at 19, and Jard, now 17 years old and growing rapidly. Jard was born looking strikingly different than anyone in his family. Long black hair that fell over a tanned face with wide green eyes and a strong jawline. He was thin but strong and had not yet begun to fill out the lanky body that promised to be imposing with age. Together the three gathered the day's bounty and headed for home, to a stone house they sat alone among the manicured fields a few miles outside of Westland, the Red City. As they walked the path that cut through their fields, Tam recited the news that he picked up on the latest trip into town. He talked of fall festivals and winter meetings, of church denunciations, and political citizenry. Among the friends, he'd tell you about every eligible girl there was as well, and he never forgot a face or a reputation. His father, Caleb, was good friends with the mayor of Westland, Darren Mirador. Hardly a week went by without a messenger coming by the farm with something from the city. So was that all that was important to know, Caleb was privy too. All that was salacious, well, to walk a mile with Tam was to age a year. Jared listened intently. He wasn't one to talk much, though he was no good at hiding what he thought. The sing-song nature of Tam's voice blended nicely with the low, serene voice of his father, which in turn melted into the cascade of noises surrounded from the nature around them. He listened to it all, some with his ears, the rest with a mysterious sixth sense, one which transcribed the chirps and howls from the forest and the fields into playful banter and territorial warnings. He wondered at times whether he just had an overactive imagination, but the books he got from the wildlife around him were too familiar to be dismissed. The smell of dinner riding upon the breeze broke him from his musing quick enough to hear Tam mention the herd of wild horses driven into Balin's stables. The dinner table was pulled from the side wall and covered thrown over it, and soon from the kitchen came the food, bowls of potatoes and carrots steamed, grilled seasoned meat, and warm garlic bread. A pie teased the room with its scents. The men clambered in and sat themselves at the table, at once filling the fire-lit room with the warm sounds of family. As the plates were cleared and the pie passed out, Caleb announced his decision to send Jared to a family friend to apprentice as a horse trainer. The room became very quiet as the news sunk in. It was a decision that the boys had followed since the idea had been floated months before. The parents had taken opposite sides on the issue, his mother insisting that he remain home while his father felt the time had come. The boy couldn't spend his whole life on the farm. He acknowledged with no small amount of frustration. He had given up trying to teach Jared farming. The boy had no interest in it. He was always to be found tending to the animals or slipping into the wood that surrounded the farm. Both of the parents had kept him close to home and hardly ever took more than a few steps toward the city. But Caleb announced that early the next morning the two of them would be heading to Balin's stables by way of the city road, which would take them through the far side of the city. Jared at first was very excited. The chance to learn the horse trade would take him out from behind the plow and put him among the animals where he wanted to be. From an early age, it was evident that he had a gift for taming the wild. He bristled at the term taming was hardly tame for himself, or so his parents constantly reminded him. He just knew instinctively how to make an animal comfortable with him, how to ease their fears. Those times he had successfully escaped his father's attention and disappeared into the forest were hours he treasured. He would spend them sitting on the forest floor, drawing to himself creatures of every kind. He found that if he concentrated hard enough, sometimes he could bring even the most shy of his hands to the sniff of the snack he was offering. He didn't know how he did it, but he felt it was his element when meandering through the trees, attracting wildlife, big and small, hunter and prey. He had one visitor more than any other, though, black wolves. Sometimes many of them, more often just a few. He soon came to know that they were never very far away from him, circling silently, watching him closely. The thought comforted him. So it came to be that early in his life he knew that if ever he was forced to choose between the company of humans or animals, except for his family, he would choose to live among the animals because they loved him for who he was, not for what he looked like. The thought tempered Jared's excitement. Animals may not care what he looked like, but people certainly did. Jared had been born with a sprawling red birthmark across his face, a pitted, bulbous mass of skin that stared at his forehead as well and fell across his nose and covered his cheek. It was all that people stared at, and faces they would make made him feel like an outcast. The times he ventured into the city, children would run from him, pointing their fingers, some laughing with cruel delight, even mocking him as some of the boys did by squashing tomatoes on their foreheads and clumsily dancing around in front of him. The humiliation impressed upon him the callousness of people, causing him to spend his days safe on the farm and exploring the forest behind it. A self-imposed banishment from the city of mysterious spires and tolling bells. The only time he saw unfamiliar faces were when his father brought in newly hired hands from the city. Their gawking stares and nudging elbows at their comrades made seeing him a gross ritual to the uninitiated. This prospect of walking through the city unleashed visions of degradation, of him trudging through the streets like some circus freak escaped from his cage. In his daydreams, he saw himself cured by the drop of liquid gold, unveiling for all to see how wrong they were to think of him ugly and deformed, showing them that all he was a regular person like them. But those were only fantasies, and faces gone pale on the young girls who looked like him were stung you from any of their jives, he muttered behind his back. It took a mountain of discipline not to answer the unkindness with his own. He wondered to himself and his gaze fell on the floor whether he wanted to learn to work with horses or that he wanted to avoid the spectacle of a freak show. His father looked down knowingly on Jared as the boy sat looking over his food, pondering, the sight causing him to lower his head as well. When a second later he stood up straight, and with a sideways glance at his mother, he cleared his throat and said, "Tomorrow morning we'll be out early, so fill a pack with enough to last you for a few weeks." "Do we have to walk through the middle of town? Can't we go around the village through the forest?" Jared blurted out, slowly looking up at his dad, his shoulders sagging, his hands looped inside his pockets. "Son, that would add hours to the trip. Why don't you want to go through town?" his father replied, knowing the answer to the question he asked. "The people, they hate me. They say terrible things, and I'm embarrassed for it." "They don't hate you, Jared. They don't even know you. They're mean because they're afraid of you, son. You don't want to hurt anyone, so soon they will see that you're nobody to be afraid of," said his father, and he lifted a forkful of pie in his mouth. But his son just stood there, and his long black hair swayed from side to side in disagreement. "I think not, father. I've never danced in front of an angry black bear because I was afraid of it. The boys in town mocked me for my birthmark. If I remember correctly, the last angry bear you met spent 2 weeks out on our front porch waiting for you to come play. I was deprived of your help in the fields because of an angry black bear," he replied, bringing a bashful grin to Jared's face at the memory. He bent down close and looked into Jared's green eyes. On his fingers traced the dark birthmark. It stared at him above the eyes just a few inches, a broad patch of lumpy red skin that stretched from his forehead down wide over his nose and spread across his left cheek. He kissed it. "I love you, son. And the mark on you makes that you special. You're destined for great things. That's what I think it means. I'm sure of it." "I know, father," Jared replied, having heard his father say that too many times. They had stopped making him feel better long ago. "But the people in town don't agree, and I'm embarrassed because I don't look like everybody else. I don't want to be special. I want to be like everyone else." "You will never be anyone else. Nobody is anyone else," said his father curtly. "Tomorrow we will be walking through town. I think soon you will see that I am right, and experience earned is its own reward." That was the end of the first chapter, as long as the introduction. For a continuation of that story, visit storiesmania.net. This has been the Stories Mania Podcast. Thank you for listening.